p.m., the Palmetto City Commission shamefully passed a racist juvenile curfew ordinance, otherwise known as Ordinance 2025-13. By a 4-to-1 vote, they are imposing a citywide juvenile curfew in lockstep with Manatee County and Bradenton, who passed their juvenile curfews earlier this year. Before the vote, PSL Tampa Bay stood shoulder to shoulder with community members at a press conference condemning the ordinance. Concerned community members filled the chambers and delivered public comments demanding the measure be rejected. Tracy Washington, the mother of Breontae Johnson Davis, addressed the commission later and stated, "The same officers that killed my son during the night shift will be the same officers enforcing the curfew on our kids. There has been still no justice for Breontae. I do not wish this on another child or family. Breontae Johnson Davis, a beloved father, brother, and friend to many, died in the Palmetto City Police Department's custody 2 years ago during a mental health crisis. Despite community outcry, no officer has ever been held accountable for his death, and instead, PPD has continued to shield and even reward those involved. We see a similar trend across the country as violent police officers are often retained and shuffled around to evade public scrutiny. Ordinance 2025-13 moves Palmetto in the wrong direction. Real safety comes from publicly funded youth programs, accountability for killer cops, and community power. PSL stands with the families and residents demanding all three." Last week, community members gathered to protest the proposed cruise ship port in Tampa Bay in between Pinellas and Manatee County. A broad coalition of conservation groups, fishing advocates, and neighborhood organizations has released a formal opposition letter outlining their concerns. They argue the project conflicts with state law, local and land use protections, and the long-term public interest in protecting one of Tampa Bay's most productive and intact coastal ecosystems. You can read the full press release and opposition letter through the updated Ruthless Truth Instagram bio. An amendment to Florida Senate Bill 302 has been filed by Jim Boyd. Organizations including Suncoast Waterkeeper and Tampa Bay Waterkeeper are currently reviewing the amendment to determine whether it genuinely strengthens the protections for Florida aquatic preserves or simply duplicates existing statutes. Follow Suncoast Waterkeeper and Tampa Bay Waterkeeper on Instagram and Facebook for updates. And tune in next month for a full episode breaking down the entire cruise port proposal, who stands to profit, what's at stake environmentally, and why local scientists and experts are warning of potential ecological fallout. A panel of Florida lawmakers last week advanced a bill, HB 221, that would allow certain types of workers, mostly trainees, to temporarily opt out of being paid the Florida state minimum wage, degrading them to the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. Despite critics warning that the bill would open the floodgates to exploitation and legalization of cheap labor, "We must remind our representatives that they work for the people, not big corporations that hate the fact that Floridians petitioned a $15 an hour minimum wage onto the ballot and voted in a supermajority to adopt it." Lastly, a fast-moving, uncontained wildfire known as the National Fire is burning in Big Cypress National Preserve, scorching more than 15,000 acres of dry marsh and grassland. Fueled by drought conditions, frost-damaged vegetation, and gusty winds, the fire has sent heavy smoke across South Florida, creating hazardous driving conditions along I-75, US 41, and State Road 19. Fire crews are battling the blaze by air and ground, but the Everglades wetland terrain makes containment difficult. While no major evacuations have been ordered, officials warn residents, especially children, seniors, and people with respiratory conditions, to limit their outdoor exposure. This fire is also a reminder of how critical federal weather and climate monitoring systems are. Satellite imagery and smoke tracking from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration help communities monitor wildfire spread, air quality, and the shifting weather patterns. Last year, the Trump administration proposed significant budget cuts to the NOAA. As wildfire risks increase with prolonged heat and drought, experts say that strong investment in early warning systems and environmental monitoring remains essential for keeping communities informed and safe.
Hello, Suncoast. Welcome back to another wonderful episode of The Ruthless Truth. We have a very special episode today, and we're going to be joined by community member from Sarasota, Alan.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show. Good to be back.
So great to have you again. So we have a very special episode. It is Black History Month, one of my favorite months. And we are going to start off by getting right into it and talking about the history of this very special month. So as many of you know, this year marks 100 years of Black History Month. It all started in 1926 when a historian and founder of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, Carter G. Woodson, established what was then called Negro History Week, which in 1976 became the month-long celebration that we know it as today. And thank goodness for that. I am so glad it's a full month now.
I think you have a quote by Carter Woodson here talking about why he thought it was so important to study Black history.
Yes, Carter G. Woodson once said, "Lead the Negro to believe this, that he is inferior, and thus control his thinking. If you can thereby determine what he will think, you will not have to worry about what he will do. You will not have to tell him to go to the back door. He will go without being told. And if there is no back door, he will have one cut for his special benefit." And yeah, so it very much shows that there is power in education, and especially emancipatory education. So through the attacks on DEI, the Trump administration's intensive efforts to minimize or even completely exclude Black people in the official narrative of history is an attempt to reinforce the ideas that Black people are incapable of contributing to our society and that their rights were given to them by certain benevolent white men. The reality is that Black history and labor history are deeply intertwined, and that many of the rights all of us have are the results of Black mass struggle, as well as the widespread solidarity in that struggle. So I'm sure everyone, especially our regular listeners, have been keeping up with the news of the general strike in Minneapolis. Now, a lot of people might not be aware exactly of what it was a response to. Alan, could you tell us a little bit about the background of what was going on in Minneapolis?
Yeah, so it was in response to an ICE operation in Minneapolis called Operation Metro Surge, basically based out of this like racist accusation that Somali daycares were running a racket. And, you know, it's kind of unspoken that, you know, ICE terror is just like a Latine issue or even just Latine and Asians. But we're seeing here that racist caricatures were used against Black immigrants too. And, you know, it's not just Somalis, it's Haitians, you know, it's Nigerians, Sierra Leoneans, you know, people from all and many Afro-Latinos as well. So for one, we don't want to erase Black immigrants from the picture. This weakens the defenses of these communities. It downplays the risk of ICE racially profiling Black citizens. And it also minimizes the higher rates of abuse that Black detainees experience while in ICE custody. But there's another side to this narrative that Black struggle and immigrant struggles are completely separate. Many of you might remember Trump's claim in his 2024 campaign trail that immigrants are taking so-called Black jobs. Do you remember that, Ira?
Yes. And what is a Black job? You know, like that, it's a quite telling statement of the way they think they're so easily able to manipulate like two groups of people against each other.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a complete fabrication. Race is the number one tool for social control that the ruling class has. I mean, our modern understanding of race in this country, you know, the whole categorization of white people, white as an exclusionary term that sets Black people as something separate and something apart. That came about in this country because enslaved Africans were finding solidarity with European indentured servants and vice versa, you know, early on in the colonial period. And, you know, the people who ran things saw that as a problem and saw the need to divide and conquer, basically, because the more we workers see each other as a problem, the less we see that it's actually, you know, the capitalists who are the problem. You know, who decides to keep wages low and profits high? It's not immigrants. It's not Black people. It's billionaires who decides to bomb all these other countries or put sanctions on them, which destabilizes them and makes people leave their countries. You know, it's our ruling class. And it's the ruling class that gave law enforcement officers, quote unquote, free rein to kill. So that difference between what the ruling class wants and what the working class wants is why we've seen mass resistance to Operation Metro Surge. On January 23rd, and so this is last month, about a month ago, 100,000 people took to the streets in Minneapolis in sub-zero temperatures. And this was the first general strike in this country since 2006. And, you know, the Trump administration, excuse me, you know, immediately afterward, the Trump administration, you know, tries to double down on the crackdown because, you know, he wants to control the narrative. And so we see another person get killed, Alex Pretty. And immediately afterward, Black and Somali youth organizations in Minneapolis see the need to escalate. And so they called for a nationwide shutdown on the 30th. And in the wake of that, Trump really quickly took steps to cool down. So what we saw in Minneapolis last month is part of Black history. Black communities were affected. Black youth and Black organizers were at the forefront of these victories. And it fits into a long tradition throughout Black history of the working class banding together, standing in solidarity with one another, and withholding our labor in order to make something big happen.
Absolutely. Our politicians will not act until we force their hand. And we have the power to do that if we strike. If politicians stop for a day, nothing changes. If billionaires stop for a day, nothing changes. If workers stop for a day, society comes to a complete halt. When we come together and strike and withhold our labor, that's when it becomes clear where the real power in society is. Now, why is this especially important to have on the forefront of our minds as we get into an election year?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. I mean, for those of us who know a little bit about the 2006 general strike, that was called a Day Without an Immigrant. And this was in response to a truly fascistic bill that had passed through the House. It was called the Sensenbrenner Bill. And that would make it a felony to do anything that, you know, could be remotely framed as helping out an undocumented immigrant, whether that's giving them food, providing them medical care, letting somebody stay in your house for a night. It would make it a felony. And there were months and months of massive protests from the end of 2005 into 2006. And then we see people call for a mass nationwide walkout of work and, you know, boycott of spending money for the day. And immediately we saw the Sensenbrenner bill get killed in the Senate. So immediately in response to this, the Sensenbrenner bill gets thrown out and talk shifts toward actually comprehensive immigration reform. And that was around the time of Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. So what was promised was that, okay, if we vote in Obama, then we will be able to pass comprehensive immigration reform. A lot of people may remember that one of his campaign slogans was, "Si se puede," yes, we can, speaking to a base of people who spoke Spanish, who may know undocumented immigrants, who may have family members who would benefit from immigration reform. And then, you know, Obama gets elected. In 2009, Democrats have control over the House, the Senate, and the presidency. But then they talk about, oh, let's wait until the midterms. You know, we have to focus on the midterms. And then midterms happen and nothing changes. So what we saw was all of the energy that had been in the streets and in the communities and among the people and people's organizations in 2006 on the Day Without an Immigrant, it effectively got diverted into the electoral system and into the Democratic Party. And then the Democratic Party failed to stay true to any of its promises until people forced their hand. So we saw in the early 2010s, tons of movement around, you know, there were sit-ins at John McCain's office. There was a group of young immigrants who walked all the way from Florida to, I believe it was Washington, D.C. And that was the kind of retaking of control by, you know, the community that eventually forced Obama's hand into creating DACA. So we can't rely on the Democratic Party again this time. You know, the midterms are happening this year, but let's look at some of the other stuff that the Democratic Party has done. Tom Homan, who is Trump's current top immigration official, he was appointed by Obama. This is the guy who piloted the family separation policy, and Obama actually gave him a medal back in 2014 because he saw Tom Homan as so effective at deportation. You know, Obama himself was actually called deporter in chief during his time as president. We remember Kamala Harris saying to people, do not come here. You know, we're seeing Hillary Clinton now openly bragging that her husband and Obama deported more people than Trump just without street executions. I've been seeing this like really, you know, interesting quote circulating around the internet. Ira, tell me if you've seen this too. If we had Democrats today and we were transported back in time to the 1860s, this would be a party that would be saying we need more humane slavery instead of a party that is saying we need to abolish slavery. And what we're seeing now is a Democratic Party that wants to continue having a mass deportation machine, but they want it to basically cause less of a stir among the people because they see how inflamed it gets people to see families getting ripped apart, you know, innocent people just snatched off the streets, the complete demonization of ordinary people to be branded as violent criminals. It's unconscionable. And this is why we see people leveraging our power as a class to end ICE terror.
Absolutely. But, you know, there's more to it because to be committed to ending ICE terror, we must also be committed to ending the same system of violence that killed Keith Porter Jr., Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, Philando Castile. So by leveraging our power, we will also end prisons and detention camps that profit off the enslaved labor of immigrants and citizens alike.
Yes. And, you know, I kind of want to shout out Harry Haywood, if people know who that is. He was a leading black member of the Communist Party USA 100 years ago. And he developed something called the Black Belt Thesis, which really put all of what you just said into a theoretical framework. And what he saw was that black self-determination was a crucial piece of the fight for liberation from capitalism. You know, he saw capitalist exploitation and, you know, labor oppression as working hand in hand with white supremacy. Going back to how, you know, we were talking about race as like a number one tool of social control, you know, for a divide and conquer strategy. He saw it as deeply important that the Communist Party adopt this theoretical framework because until black people are free in this country, nobody is free, really.
Yes. Thank you so much for saying that, Alan. I couldn't phrase that better. In black history, we see many of the most revolutionary advancements of working class rights in U.S. history. And behind many of these advancements, despite the same attempts made by those on top to divide us by race, were workers of all backgrounds striking side by side to advance the common goal. And those workers continue to strike side by side because they were organizing alongside socialist and communist parties. Because socialism understands the codependency between exploitation and white supremacy. And because socialism aims to take down exploitation and white supremacy from their roots, it will create a revolution against capitalism. And socialist revolution will be part of Black history. You know, the Communist Party saw that. And the Black Panthers saw that. And the Party for Socialism and Liberation sees that.
Yeah, and I want to illustrate this through by going back to the Black Belt thesis and this different idea around self-determination. Harry Haywood's theory was different than Marcus Garvey's kind of back to Africa, kind of more separatist idea of Black liberation. You know, that's not to discount the very important work that Marcus Garvey did around building a Pan-Africanist movement. But Harry Haywood really emphasized that liberation comes from uniting across racial boundaries, across gender boundaries. Every tool that the ruling class uses to try to divide us, we need to overcome and fight against the system side by side. The tradition that this is a tradition for liberation that we started to see really get applied practically in the 1930s with the Alabama Sharecroppers Union. This was, you know, a Communist Party looking at where is the most critical area that we need to apply this thesis to. And they saw that Black sharecroppers in the South were essentially the most oppressed workers in the entire country. So Communist Party members went to Alabama and helped both Black and white sharecroppers form union locals. And they really emphasized this idea of cross-racial unity and also organizing themselves so that they had a base of community power that was beholden to them and their demands and, what they were fighting for, so that they could resist the massive amounts of basically oppression that they were facing as retaliation from sheriffs and the state.
Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah, the KKK and these company owners. And so from there, we see this kind of different idea around Black liberation develop into the 40s. So we have A. Philip Randolph, who founded the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. And he was a member of the Socialist Party, and he was looking at basically the labor relationships in the sleeping cars of trains. And porters and maids were exclusively Black, and they were essentially reproducing the master-slave relationship with the majority white passengers. And at the same time, you know, this was during World War II, and Black people were basically being completely shut out of federal industries, notably defense, where there were actually tons of job openings. And so A. Philip Randolph basically organized a march on Washington. This was saying, we're going to have 100,000 Black workers marching on Washington if you do not open federal jobs up to Black people. And he pointed out the hypocrisy of the U.S. claiming to fight fascism abroad while maintaining white supremacy at home. And so this builds and builds and builds. And then 6 days before the march was scheduled, Roosevelt passes an executive order basically against discrimination in federal employment and defense and other government agencies, and the creation of the Fair Employment Practices Committee to enforce this. And, you know, we see a direct parallel between this and Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in 1963, which one of the demands for that was a ban on discrimination for all employment. you know, we think about the March on Washington as just being a civil rights thing, but it was civil rights and labor rights. So we see this tradition continuing to build. Eventually, we saw this take the form of the Black Power movement of the later 60s and the 70s, which was one of the most radical and forward-thinking manifestations of this tradition. It was the most virulently against capitalism, explicitly, and it really was completely committed to this idea of Black self-determination, of empowering the Black community to have its own power and not be dependent on ruling class politicians or organizations or parties in order to advance their rights. And this is an idea that some people might know as dual power. This is what the Black Panther Party was trying to build. The Communist Party was at this time starting to decline in power. And so the Black Panther Party saw the need for them to come in and be this foundation for working class power that the Communist Party was no longer able to do. And not just a foundation of power, but a foundation of power that saw the importance of cross-race unity, cross-gender unity, of, you know, not just a Black separatist liberation theory, but one that had its roots, theoretical roots, in Harry Haywood's Black Belt thesis. And this is a tradition that we have to be really conscious of upholding today. You know, we can't let the energy of the general strike that happened in Minneapolis last month get diverted back into a ruling class party, the Democratic Party. We have to continue to build our own power as a working class, because it's not just ending ICE terror that depends on it. It's Black liberation. It's liberation for all workers from capitalism. It's liberation for people all across the country who are experiencing aggression from the United States because the United States wants to protect overseas business interests. You know, the need for this knowledge of our class power when we stand in solidarity is needed now more than ever, in my lifetime at least.
Absolutely. And I just want to say thank you so much for being here today, Alan. It is so important that we make sure that we learn from history so we continue this long history of struggle.
Thank you for having me, Ira. It's always a pleasure to be able to come on to the show and talk about history. I love talking about history. If people want to hear more about this, I will be at a public study that is being hosted up at Allendale Church in St. Pete this Saturday. It's going to be hosted by the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Thank you so much, Alan. Hopefully our listeners will see you there. And now on to Next in Neighborhood.
Thanks for sticking with us throughout this episode. We hope you learned something. And lastly, our Next in Neighborhood section, telling you about what's happening in your community. Join Un Pueblo Unido for their weekly vigil as we stand in solidarity with our immigrant neighbors and demand to end their detention and deportation. This will be held in Payne Park Pavilion, 2010 Adams Lane, Sarasota, 4 to 5 p.m. So please bring donations to support families whose lives have been affected by ICE arrests. It's time for a general strike. Join us for an educational presentation and discussion on the history of strikes throughout Black history and how we can leverage our power as workers to stop ICE terror. Saturday, February 28th, 12 p.m., Allendale Church in St. Petersburg. Save the date. The Tampa Immigrant Rights Committee is putting together an International Women's Day celebration on March 8th. International Women's Day originated in a protest led by women garment workers in New York, where women protested dangerous work conditions, wage theft, child labor, and grueling work hours. So this International Women's Day, we call on everyone to stand with immigrant women and demand no ICE in our cities. Follow them at Tampa IRC for event updates. That was our show for today, but stay in the know and tune in next week for more political analysis. To learn more about our shows or to share your thoughts with us, follow on Instagram or Facebook at The Ruthless Truth Radio.